Morning, Oregon. I'm Finn J.D. John, FJ at offbeatoregon.com, and this is the Daily Offbeat Oregon History Podcast. Thanks for downloading, and I hope you enjoy the show. This story was first published on August 3rd of 2025, under the headline, Oregon Almost Became Part of Canada Once, eh? This is part one of a two-part presentation of this story. Part two will be on the podcast tomorrow. Here we go. For most people today, the story of the original colony of Astoria is remembered, if it's remembered at all, as a dismal failure. It was an ill-equipped party sent out by a rich guy in New York, which failed and was forced to sell out at fire sale prices to the British. And yeah, that's all kind of true. But maybe the most interesting thing about Fort Astoria is if John Jacob Astor's explorers had stayed home, or even left a year later than they did, the Oregon country would probably be part of Canada today. Going a bit farther and being quite a bit more speculative, if Astor had made even slightly less awful hiring decisions when he launched the project, the British would likely have ended up locked out of the entire central west coast, from Mexico to Alaska, and it's possible, if not likely, that it would have become its own independent country, governed or ruled by Astor's descendants. To explain all that historical what-if-ery, I need to give you a Cliff's Notes version of the story of the Astoria Project. It started when John Jacob Astor, a very active German merchant who had made an enormous fortune trading beaver and other furs from the woods of the Great Lakes states, learned what the Lewis and Clark expedition had found around the mouth of the Columbia River. Realizing that this was an enormous trading empire just sitting there up for grabs, he started making plans for the foundation of the Pacific Fur Company. Astor's plans were stupendous and audacious. He wanted to send an overland party following the tracks of Lewis and Clark, establishing trading posts along the way, out to what is today Astoria. At the same time, he'd be sending a sailing ship around the Horn to establish a great emporium at the mouth of the Columbia, roughly where Fort Clatsop had been. Then his trappers and traders would run up and down the Columbia and its tributaries and along the coast, trading with Indians for beaver and otter pelts and paying for them with cheap knives, glass beads, and itchy but warm wool blankets. The pelts would be shipped across the Pacific to China, where the Mandarin class prized otter pelts especially to trim their robes and paid steep prices for them. Back the ships would come, then, holds crammed with goods from China, to reap even more huge profits selling black tea, silks, china, and other exotic goods in European markets. It would be a huge trading empire, springing to life at the mouth of the Columbia River and making tremendous amounts of money. To implement his vision, Astor hired two key leaders. For the overland party, he tapped a New Jersey businessman named Wilson Price Hunt, and for the waterborne party, a rigid, abrasive Navy officer named Jonathan Thorne. It is very hard to say now, with the clear hindsight of history, which of these two hiring decisions was worse. The competition for that dubious honor, as we shall shortly see, was fierce indeed between them. Astor referred to Thorne as his gunpowder man. As captain of Astor's sailing ship, Tonquin, he was an absolute martinet, very decisive and a strict disciplinarian. Astor picked him because at this time the British were making a habit of stopping American merchant ships and kidnapping sailors to be pressed into military service in the Napoleonic Wars. And indeed, early in the voyage, a ship did try to stop the Tonquin, most likely for that purpose. It was Thorne's time to shine. And he did, manning the ship's 10 cannon and making it very clear that the other ship would have to fight for it. It sheered away, and they got through. But the passengers and crew of the Tonquin would probably have been much better off if they had been drafted into the Royal Navy. The majority of them would be dead within a year because of Thorne. Thorne was, to give the devil his due, a brave man. He was also, unfortunately, completely without impulse control when angry, and he was often angry. And he had a streak of malice that did not always stop short of murder. His job was to bring a large cohort of passengers, mostly partners, whom Astor was paying for their services with a slice of the business, along with a number of French voyageurs and clerks and clerical workers, around to the new colony. Thorne got off to a bad start right away by trying to impose an 8 p.m. curfew on the partners. Thorne, the Navy officer and ship captain, saw mutiny and insubordination in nearly everything these mountain man fur traders did. They, in turn, considered him a mere employee. Things reached a head when the ship stopped at the Falkland Islands to refill its water casks. While the big party of the partners were ashore on the treeless, foodless island, Thorne weighed anchor and tried to maroon them there, apparently figuring Astor would be well rid of such unruly dopes. Fortunately for the marooned men, one of their friends pulled a pair of pistols and told Thorne, "Turn back, or you are a dead man this instant!" The ship got to them just in time, as the marooned men had been pulling after the ship in their rowboat, and they had just broken an oar and were in the trough of the sea and well on their way to being swamped and drowned in the open sea. When the Tonquin arrived at the mouth of the Columbia, Thorne ordered his first mate, Mr. Fox, with whom he was feuding because Fox had befriended some of those hated passengers, to launch a rowboat and sound out the channel across the bar. It was tantamount to a suicide mission, and thus the seas were very high. Thorne staffed the boat with voyageurs, risking only Fox and one other sailor from his own crew. The boat got not far from the Tonquin when the signal flag was waved in a distress call. Thorne ignored it, and soon it disappeared. Along with all of its occupants, the boat was never seen again. Another boat was launched after the seas had quieted a bit, but failed to find the channel. Then a third boat did find the channel, but Thorne, his thirst for blood apparently not yet fully slaked, sailed straight past the boat and onto the bar, making no attempt to stop for or even throw a rope to his benefactors. They had to make their way ashore as best they could, and two of them, against all odds, actually survived. There in Baker Bay, the company men disembarked with their trade goods and supplies to build Fort Astoria. Then Thorne sailed the Tonquin out to do some trading among the Indians. For his first foray into trading for sea otter pelts, Thorne put into a little cove on Vancouver Island. There he attempted to impose his Navy discipline on a First Nations chief, barking out an unacceptably low price in blankets and knives and getting angry when it was not immediately agreed to. Finally, without having budged on his price, he seized the chief and threw him ignominiously overboard. The next morning, the Indians returned to the Tonquin, accepted Thorne's price, and started trading. But just as Thorne was probably starting to think he'd cracked the code for negotiating with Indians, one of their leaders gave a signal and they whipped out their knives and war clubs and avenged the insult to their chief. The next day, the sole survivor of the attack touched off the powder magazine, and that was the end of the Tonquin, along with a great many natives who had climbed aboard to explore their prize. This might have been the moment when Astor's project transitioned from long shot to doomed endeavor. Honestly, though, there are so many others we could point to, and we'll get busy pointing to them when we pick this story back up in part two of this two-part story in tomorrow's episode. Key sources in this story included works by Peter Stark and OregonEncyclopedia.org. Well, that's our show for today. Thanks again for listening. This podcast is part of Offbeat Oregon History, a public history resource for the state we love. What you've been listening to is one of more than 700 stories originally created and published as newspaper columns in first-run syndication between 2008 and today. You can read them all at offbeatoregon.com. Other Offbeat Oregon goodies include an active Facebook page, a ton of historic photos, and a bunch more stuff, including visuals for today's show and full citations to sources. All accessible via our hub page at offbeatoregon.com. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band and was written by Carmen Ficarra. Listen and learn more at atlasstringband.com. Episodes of Offbeat Oregon History are uploaded around 6 a.m. every weekday, so the next one will be on your device and ready to go before you know it. Until then, go out and fill up the rest of the day with good stuff. Bye now.